amenazó. So, this afternoon we turn to mindfulness of breathing. And if you've been practicing for a while, focusing on the rise and fall of the abdomen, kind of gets smooth, not too bumpy. But you seem to be kind of hitting a ceiling that you're not getting, you're not elevating above. Then breaking through the ceiling and coming up to the apertures of the nostrils can be very helpful. On a number of occasions, when people have met with me one-on-one, if they've been focusing on the rise and fall of the abdomen, sometimes they will comment, well, it's getting a little bit boring. And then I say, well, just try coming up here, up to the apertures of the nostrils, where the sensations are subtler. And right there, that does the trick. That is, the boring part vanishes. And of course, there's really nothing in terms of sheer interest value. They're not more interesting up here at the apertures of the nostrils than they are at the abdomen. So what's the difference? And what is the difference? You should know by now. What? Go ahead. Just say it again. Exactly that. It is just that simple. And that is, if there's greater vividness, whatever it is that you're attending to is more engaging, it's more interesting, because the brighter light you're shining upon it. And the sensations here at the apertures of the nostrils do tend to be subtler. So if you rise to the occasion, that is, you engage with them, remaining connected, then that will arouse greater vividness. Greater vividness means it's more satisfying and it's more interesting, oddly enough, in a kind of a totally non-cognitive or intellectual way. It is more engaging. The only reason that you might want to come down, a couple of reasons, let's say, is one, if you do start, and I'm now looking ahead, you know, 2 weeks from now and a month from now and so forth, if at any time when you're focusing on the apertures of the nostrils, if you do feel some kind of a congealing of energy, of pressure, and so forth in the head, that's the time to back down, okay? Just don't let that one linger because it can build up. Just come right back down to the abdomen, so that'd be one good reason, or full body awareness. And then the other one is that if you're attending there to the breath and it gets so subtle that you're really having to strain, and I chose exactly the verb I wanted. If you're really having it strain, oh, this is so hard, but I can hardly pick it up. And there, the word strain, well, you don't want to strain. You want to be sharp, to be focused, to arouse attention, all of that. But strain, no. This practice should not be one of strain. If that happens, then come back down again to the abdomen, even just for just a little while, and see if in that groundedness, in that deep relaxation, the ease or the easiness of attending to the course of sensations, if the mind can, the rumination can calm down a little bit. Because there's a direct correlation there. If there's still a fair amount of noise in the mind of just chit-chat, rumination coming up, then it's harder to detect subtle sensations. Whereas if it's just quieter, just not so much noise in the mind, then it's easier. And you'll pick up the subtler sensations, and then you'll find that all the more satisfying, that it's silkier, it's smoother, it's more subtle, and there you continue in the practice in that way. So, that's that. I must say this is one of my dearest friends, mindfulness of breathing. I really, really like it. Old friends. First type of Buddhist meditation I ever did. On my own, self-taught, in Germany, 42 years ago. But I really took to it. I loved it. I still do. So I hope you can develop an affection for this practice, because if you do, it will serve you well. And of course, it's always a lovely place, even if you're very enamored with settling the mind or awareness of awareness. Always a nice, comfortable place to come back to. Oh, yeah, this one. This one's relatively easy. And just settle back. And again, just a brief reminder that I want to go right into it. But that nice, gentle undulation, just as the breath is flowing in and flowing out as effortlessly as can be, then that gentle arousal during in-breath, that release through the out-breath, and pick up the counting, just like you pick up a piece of silverware. Pick it up insofar it's useful, and as soon as it's not useful, just put it right back down again. And do make sure that insofar as you are using the counting, that your mindfulness stays on the breath and doesn't shift over to mindfulness of counting. Okay? All right, that's all basically repetition, but sometimes it could hear things 20 or 30 times. And then it sinks in. Okay? Find a comfortable position. I will reiterate just once again one of the distinctive qualities about this practice. It's just tonic. It's just like a tonic for the whole prana system, you know? More so than settling the mind, that can really rattle the nervous system. Awareness of awareness can get you a bit high-pitched, a bit strung out. This is the one that just comes back and just mellows the whole thing out, just settles, assimilates, helps to balance. And so this is why it's such a good complement to the other two practices. So today I'm going to try to give short answers. You know how good I am at that, but I'll try my best. Oh, yeah. Okay. I've had a hard time grasping the concept of infinite. You have my sympathy. Buddhism speaks of the beginningless origin of our universe and belief of infinite number of world systems as well. Mm-hmm. Given the hypothesis that it is fair to assume that a lot of planets like ours and forms of intelligent life has existed as well, not just a lot, but infinite, is this the case? It would be quite presumptuous to assume that this is the first time that Dharma has been understood and practiced. So if we all have been exposed to endless number of teachings and experience on spiritual matters, how come we haven't all achieved enlightenment? And what would make us believe that it is possible to do so on this lifetime or in the next 100? Yeah, the same thought occurred to me. And actually, I wrote on that in the last chapter. So if you want to, the longer answers, I'm going to give a short answer here. The last chapter of Dreaming Yourself Awake addresses exactly that. How literally should we take beginningless? Does that really necessarily mean infinite? And I can say right now that the notion of infinite that is in Tibetan, it's tangmet, has a corresponding Sanskrit term, countless. Countless in Buddhist context can just mean just too many to count. Right? But there's a lot of subtlety there, but rather than trying, I probably spent about the next 40 minutes unpacking that one, but I've already done it. And so if you don't have a copy, then there are a number of, I think, 17 copies floating around. Read the last chapter of Dreaming Yourself Awake, and that addresses that in quite some detail and shows that there are, there are other ways of interpreting this whole notion of beginningless rather than absolutely literal infinite number. And so I'll leave it at that. Otherwise, I'd really go on long, and I kind of like not to. I've done that yesterday, and so put it that. And another answer is, which is really actually very short, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Back in the Pali Canon, this was, at the time of the Buddha, it was philosophically a very rich time. There was no church like Brahmanic church or the Jaina church. There was no church that imposed its will and demanded uniformity among the sadhus, the pundits, the scholars, the Brahmins of India. I think if they'd ever tried, I think they would have just had their hopes dashed anyway, because the Indians had never been good at that, bless their souls, of just everybody marching to the same tune. It's been pluralistic and diverse for all of recorded history. And so there were a lot of very bright, very philosophical minds at the time of the Buddha, and some of these philosophers would come to the Buddha and they'd ask these kind of questions. Does the universe have a beginning or not? And they're already sharpening their knives. If you say it's a beginning, we're going to get you. If you say it doesn't have a beginning, we're going to get you. And he said, cool it. He didn't quite say it in so many terms, but pretty much he said, cool it, you know. You're not going to get any satisfaction with that. You're not going to get any satisfaction with the question. And you're not going to get any satisfaction. No matter what the answer is, you'll get no satisfaction. Because it's just going to give you more food for thought, but the thought doesn't go anywhere. So in the meantime, are you suffering or not? Can you identify the sources of suffering or not? Would you like to consider the hypothesis that maybe suffering isn't necessary, nor are its causes? And if so, would you like to consider ethics and samadhi and wisdom? If so, okay, we'll get to the question later, if it still lingers. So there's no sarcasm there, and there's no disparagement. It's just it is to say that life is short, and here we are, and there are big issues at stake. And the issues are much smaller if we really do get terminated at death, so that's much, much easier. Then it's kind of like somebody mentioned, in fact, I think you might know who it was, playing poker for grains of sand, right? and how low tension that is. Okay, like I get my handful and you get your handful. Okay, now let's see who's going to win the poker game. Well, it's grains of sand, so who really cares? You know, it's grains of sand. And although that is a bit of an exaggeration, if this is life is it, and moreover, it can be snuffed out at any time, bingo, you're dead, then it's a low-stakes poker game, frankly, because you're going to lose anyway. Or you win anyway, that if what you really want is termination of suffering, then you're going to win. All you have to do is wait, right? Whereas if this continuity of consciousness continues on, then suddenly it's a very high-stakes poker game. Because now it really becomes, it focuses in on this lifetime. The notion of procrastinating becomes utter foolishness, and the notion of taking stock, what are your opportunities here and now in this lifetime? And just with the eyes wide open, no dogma, no doctrine, nothing outside here, just take stock. Look at the 7 billion people on the planet. Look at your own aspirations. Look at your own opportunities. Look at the possibilities of liberation, of awakening, and so forth and so on. And then consider, okay, how do I best want to spend my time? And that's an interesting question, and that's why I wrote a whole chapter on it. But when all is said and done, here we are, and here's the practice. And can we lead lives that are less harmful towards other people and towards the environment? Is that possible? And I think the answer is yes. We can be more benevolent, less injury, less harm. And can we do something with this mind to get it into shape, more balanced, more benevolent, the heart opening? Is that possible? If so, that's just got to be good. And then during this brief lifespan, can we gain some really profound, perhaps pivotal insight into just what's going on, the nature of reality, the nature of ourselves, nature of mind, the role of mind in nature? This is high stakes. And so it's a matter of sequence. And again, there's nothing wrong with the question. Perfectly good question. But I remember, I'll give you this, end on this analogy, or this, not analogy, it's an instance. Years ago when I was about 22, I think, 22, very young, I'd been in Dharamsala maybe a year, maybe two. But I just picked up, I saw a really like a 10 rupee print, color print of Kalachakra. This is so the deity of some really very extraordinary system of Vajrayana Buddhism. It's absolutely mind-stunning when you start to study it. But I was just really drawn to it. I didn't know why, but I was really drawn to it. This blue deity, multiple arms, golden consort standing. And I just wanted to know more about it. You know, what's Kalachakra? What's Kalachakra? And I'd been studying for maybe all of a year, year and a half. And I went down to visit one of the greatest sages in modern Tibetan history, one of the tutors of the Dalai Lama, Gyatso Tsedzang Rinpoche. I mean, just an absolutely stellar scholar, bodhisattva, incredibly accomplished contemplative. He was everything. And I went and got an interview with him, and he was like 80 years old at the time. And I said, I've heard about Kalachakra. Can I learn about that? And this man was just immensely, there was just such incredible sweetness about him. Incredible sweetness. So sweet. Just like the grandfather everybody would want to have, you know? And he just looked at me with incredible kindness and said, oh, that's very good that you have that interest. But you're not quite ready for that yet. And it was like I was a school child, like an 8-year-old who had suddenly heard about Stephen Hawking and quantum cosmology and sought out Stephen Hawking, you know, somehow managed to get an interview with Stephen Hawking, my 8-year-old, you know? And Mr. Hawking, and he said, yes, you know? And I said, I'd like to learn about quantum cosmology. I'm really fascinated about the notion that actually the past is in a superposition state. It sounds really cool to me. Could you teach me that? And his answer, if you're in a very good mood, might be, good question, but not quite yet. Good question, not quite yet. The mind won't wrap itself around it. Not yet. Go deeper, and then it will. Or the question will dissolve, one of the two. Can you talk about settling the mind and awareness of awareness in regards to dream yoga? Sure. Settling the mind is the perfect preparation for lucid dreaming. And I've referred to that so many times, of seeing thoughts as thoughts, seeing dreams as dreams, voila, you're lucid in the waking state and while sleeping. And then awareness of awareness is the perfect preparation for becoming lucid in dreamless sleep, which then gives you a direct access to the substrate consciousness. So we can follow up with that, but there's the natural pairing. They're just two mated. One is daytime, one is nighttime practice. Perfect preparation. So another one on Tuesday evening, you alluded to the possibility of two lucid dreamers in one dream. Can you say a bit more? What I can say is, if you have a lucid dream, see if anybody else is lucid. Somebody just reported on a lucid dream to me, their own lucid dream, and checked with other people in the dream. And just like when I checked, nobody was interested in the question. Quite interesting. They just didn't want. They were just busy. One actually said, when asked a question, just said, "Shh." Very cute. Very cute. So if you do have a dream, a lucid dream, and you find somebody else who's lucid, let me know. Drop me an email. Does that mean there's two of you? How many people are there in your dream? I thought there was only one. I thought that was you. But if you find somebody else is lucid, learn more about that person. Is it possible to have two plus lucid dreamers? And if so, what would this do to the dream? Well, that's what I'm saying. Check it out. That's an empirical question. Look for an empirical answer. See if you can find anybody. If you have a lucid dream, just ask anybody. Even, you know, your dog. Bark twice if you think this is a dream. And see what happens. Hola, so could you give some advice to those already have committed to Yidam practice? For example, Shamatha Vipassana, generation stage, completion stage. So there's real classic. And you would want to, if you're really going to do this classically, and as you probably know, I like to use that word, because it's not just tradition. Sometimes tradition sucks. I mean, it's just heavy and burdensome and has gotten stuck in a rut. So tradition as such is not that necessarily that great. But, you know, when I looked at classic practices by the greatest of teachers, Nagarjuna, Asanga, Atisha, Shantideva in the Mahayana tradition, or Nagasena, Buddha Gosa, and so forth, Theravada tradition, and then on into Tibet and so forth, there's just something just radiant to my mind, just kind of radiant. When you go to the greatest of the greats and you read their writings and read of their experiences and what they say about the path, and everything else kind of fades compared to that. You know, unless they're reflecting that and embodying that in the modern world. So classic is cool. And so if you're going to follow this very classic route, stage of generation, stage of completion, then what are the, it's kind of like you want to bake a Vajrayana cake. And the Vajrayana cake is baked in two stages, stage of generation, stage of completion. So then you can ask, well, what are the ingredients to bake this cake? Okay? And one of these, it's not indispensable, but it certainly helps to have achieved shamatha already. Then you're coming in with a really serviceable mind, which is a really good idea. And if you look at Gampopa, look at the Lamde teachings in the Sakya tradition, look at the Lamrim teachings in the Gelugpa tradition, and so forth. They're all teaching shamatha in Sutrayana teachings. Tsongkhapa does it in great detail. Achieve shamatha, then vipassana, and then he gives his teachings on Vajrayana. And so many of the others in all four traditions do so as well. Is it possible to achieve shamatha within the state of regeneration? Yes, it is. But it's really difficult. I have to say, it's really difficult. So on the stage of, kind of say, Sutrayana practice, your foundational practice, developing really pure motivation, renunciation first, really renunciation, right? And then developing your bodhicitta, as authentic as you can make it, based on the four immeasurables. And then your shamatha, and then your vipassana, some insight into emptiness. It can't just be into personal identitiveness. It's got to be emptiness, emptiness of all phenomena. Otherwise, stage of generation doesn't take off. It's more like a child's game. It doesn't work. So those, renunciation, bodhicitta, shamatha, vipassana, classic sequence. And with that, then you have all the ingredients. And then you go for tantric empowerment, transmission, teachings from a qualified teacher. And then, if you have those qualities that I just mentioned, you've actually achieved shamatha, have some genuine insight into emptiness, you have authentic bodhicitta, and then you seek out a qualified, really, really qualified, lama, and receive empowerment, transmission, and explanation. Then, the sky's the limit. I don't know what you couldn't achieve, because you really have everything together. You really, I don't know what you couldn't achieve. But if you go into, you go after the, get the initiation, and not having really done much of any shamatha practice at all, maybe a little bit, maybe a month, maybe a week here, 10 days there, 10 days there, or haven't really developed bodhicitta, just, you know, liturgies and thinking about it and practicing a bit of Donglen, but not really arising, intellectual understanding of emptiness, but nothing much more, then you can practice Dhyana generation for a long, long time. It can be hard, because you don't have the ingredients. You know, it's hard to bake a cake without the ingredients. So that would be the sequence there. How to integrate the shamatha vipassana practice into their daily practice. So how to balance between development and discovery approaches. That's really very individual. What I would say is, of course, I've mentioned so many times the importance of sequence, of path, and so forth. At the same time, you remember that story when I was like, what was it, 1973, when I was 23. Then, remember the story, I went to my Lama, Geshe Ngawen Taiki, a marvelous Geshe, and was telling him how far ahead Vajrayana was to me, that I was utterly unprepared. And he said, oh, very good insight, now go get empowerment immediately. You know, so what he was saying there is, sure, he was the one that taught me the path. He taught me Lamrim. Magnificent. 8 months, 6 days a week. He just downloaded the Lamrim. It's fantastic. The strategy, the format, the sequence there. So intelligent, so good, so virtuous, and so wise. So on the one hand, we have the sequence, but on the other hand, it's ever so important. When you see, okay, this is the nature of the path. It's not just a bit of practice here and there, make it up as you go. Or just go what you like going into a candy shop, and I'll say, I'll take two of those, and one of those, and three of these, and then just kind of mix it up together in your own little candy bag. That's not a path, you know. It's kind of like just a goodie sack, you know. A little bit of dumo, a little bit of pachur, a little bit of any, oh, a little, I like this one, and oh, I really like that one, and it's okay, that's very sweet, but there's not a path. And so, on the one, having the notion of a path, but the other, having, on the other hand, being aware of the discovery model, being aware of spontaneity, of insights that will just crop up just of their own accord. And so the teachings that I've received over the last, more or less pretty much 40 years, has been, get a good understanding of the nature of the path. And focus on those practices for which you really get tangible benefit. You know they're benefiting, not just a leap of faith. Things like shamatha, four immeasurables, bodhicitta, donglen, basic foundational vipassana, the four applications of mindfulness, and lojong. There's just a wealth of practices that are definitely not too advanced for us. We can definitely get benefit from. And while you're working there and tilling the soil in these foundational practices, then to introduce some state regeneration practice. Maybe some chut. Some people are very drawn to chut practice. I won't try to explain it, but there's that. You might do some of that as well. And so forth. So to grace your practice, to season it with practices that you're not really fully prepared for yet, but nevertheless to sow those seeds. Eventually then, since you're giving something like, let's say, 80% of your time and effort is focused on practices that you really can do and not ones that you do a mere faint facsimile, you know, but you really can do, you really see the benefit, you understand them, you derive the benefit from them, and then 20%, this is where you're sowing the seeds for, you know, practices that you may be ready for in 10 years, in 20 years, three lifetimes, whatever it is. But you've sown the seeds, so when you do mature there, you're already kind of in motion, and you're how do you say, already have the momentum up. So, in that way, have some balance between, on the one hand, sequence, but also bringing in the more advanced practices. How to go about a 3 to 6 month long shamatha retreat? Is there any preferred method among three? Well, that's why we have all of our personal meetings, one-on-one meetings, because they're all unique. I've never said the same thing to two people in any session. Otherwise, I just play a tape recorder. You know? Here's the right answer. It's unique, and so that's where your own personal predilections, and it's not just one method, but possibly a balancing of methods, possibly as the weeks, months go by, a progression of the methods, going from one evolving to another. So I don't want to give a generic answer there, because then people might feel they must fit that mold. To assist more over other two on achieving shamatha on a mental image and generation stage. For that, again, it differs. Some people, again, I mentioned artists, architects, contractors, and so forth, that spend a lot of time in their profession, and they got into the profession because they had a natural propensity for visualization, for mental imagery. Some people will just take to that. If they have strong sense of devotion, so it's not just technique, not just ability to generate mental images, but also real devotion, whether to Buddha Shakyamuni, to Tsongkhapa, to Padmasambhava, to Tara, wherever it may be. If one has just a natural ability, or maybe it's a cultivated ability, and really has a devotion, then sure, this is why so many of the great teachers of India and Tibet taught focusing on a mental image of the Buddha as your shamatha practice. So it is certainly possible. And having watched Westerners practice for about 40 years, it seems to be quite rare to find people who can do that and relax enough, hold the image and relax enough. Because bear in mind, you have to get more and more and more relaxed as you proceed along those nine stages. And almost all the Westerners that I know who've done that don't get relaxed enough. It's just too much effort holding that image, and then they can't relax. And then the sweetness of the practice, the mellowness of the practice, the flow, the enjoyment doesn't rise because you're always there holding on with too much effort. So this is why I've gone back to the Buddha's own teachings. If you have a lot of rumination, mindfulness of breathing, to Dzogchen Lingpa's teachings, if you have a lot of rumination, settling the mind, and then awareness of awareness. So, now, one possibility, of course, is to achieve shamatha any way you can, any method that works, anyone that you're really drawn to, that you enjoy, you benefit from, and you see that the free qualities are really being cultivated, and just go for it, finish the thing. Find a conducive environment. That's a big one, an enormous one, where you can really just plunk down, not have to worry about anything on the outside, and continue in a conducive environment, preferably with some good companions, and then just go for it, you know? Once you've achieved shamatha in any way, and you're resting there in the substrate consciousness, at that point, visualization is just really easy. It's just so easy. Your mind is so luminous. It's so non-conceptual that you toss up an image, and it has no competition. It has no competition at all. So you just, oh, there it is. It's kind of like hovering. There's no friction. There's nothing to rip it apart. And you know it rips it apart now. If you try to visualize right now, you know, it's like putting a chicken in a cage full of weasels. Nasty, you know. You just have little chicken parts all over the place real quickly, you know. And that's what happens to your mental image, right? It just gets shredded by all the little weasels of rumination coming in. Just, and all you see is feathers. Like, whoa, where did it go? A lot of happy weasels, but I don't see my image anymore, you know. But when you're just resting in the substrate consciousness, there are no weasels. There's just nothing, there's no corrosive force. There's nothing to rip it apart. You just put it there. It's almost like being in deep space and propelling some rocket or something and just pushing it. Imagine just being in deep space and then just getting it with your hand and just pushing a rock out into deep space. What happens to it? It just keeps on going and going and going. Because, oh, what is it? It's 3 degrees Kelvin, so it's really cold. And the density of atoms, I think it's something like the density of atoms in space is something, it's a vague memory, something like the density of stars in the sky, in space. In other words, very few stars, very few, a lot of space, so very few atoms, which is just simply to say there's hardly any friction. So you just go like that, and just keep going, 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 going. And that's why, likewise, generate a mental image, just going, 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 going. Easy. So then achieve shamatha all over again on a mental image. Should be really easy. And then go for sage regeneration. Oh, lasso. And how to prepare for a 3-year Yidam retreat in terms of shamatha? Yeah. How to prepare? Well, I've said it already in a way. Bear in mind, as far as I can tell, I did check with one knowledgeable monk in a monastery in Tibet quite a few years back. He'd done a 3-year retreat, benefited from it, so he was by no means a critic. And I asked him, and it was in Tibet, and I asked him, when did this start? Because nowadays, especially in the Kagyu Nyingma tradition, to a lesser extent in the Sakya Gelug tradition, it's kind of like if you're really serious, if you're a really dedicated practitioner, they say, oh, you're really serious. Oh, then go for a 3-year retreat. As if that's the only show in town. You know, if you're not serious, okay, well then do this and that, the other thing. But if you're, oh, well then 3-year retreat if you're serious. And if you're really serious, do 2 3-year retreats. Oh, you're really serious? Then do 3 3-year retreats. You know? Like, that's the only show in town. Milarepa never did a three-year retreat. Tsongkhapa never did a three-year retreat. I don't think Gampopa ever did a three-year retreat. Dujum Lingpa never did a three-year retreat. So when did this happen that everybody's kind of like marching in the same tune? Three-year retreats. And so I asked this knowledgeable monk in Tibet some years ago, and he said, to his best knowledge, so I'm not referring to him as, you know, the supreme authority, but he was a knowledgeable monk, and what he had to say may very well be true. He said this whole thing of three retreats, he said, as far as he knew, it was started by a 19th century lama, Bhatu Rinpoche, the great Bhatu Rinpoche, extraordinary lama, and he started it. And he started it because so many monks weren't meditating at all. And so he thought, you know, they might think it's kind of all or nothing. And then if you're not a tulku, if you're a tulku, you're kind of born with a silver spoon. You know, like, okay, you're one of the chosen ones. You're a reincarnation of somebody special. And so you might have a shot. But if you're just ordinary person, you kind of wait, is anybody going to identify me? Anybody identify me? I'm good, you know. Nobody wants to identify me. Not even tulku of my uncle. Tulku of anything. Something better than a dog. You know? And, you know, most of us don't get identified. Or if we did get identified, we'd wish we hadn't been. And so if you're one of the proletariat, unlike the aristocracy of tulkus, and there are a number of Western tulkus, and then of course many, many Tibetans. If you're among the proletariat and you're a Tibetan, you might just think, you know, I'm just an ordinary person. Who am I to think that I could achieve anything? I'm just an ordinary person. So this monk commented that just a lot of monks and nuns just weren't really doing any serious meditation at all. So Bhatu Rinpoche said, okay, how do we get these people kick-started? Get them into it. Well, don't tell them achieve shamatha or achieve vipassana or achieve stage of generation or achieve anything, but rather, hey, we got a format here. Here's a three-month, three-day format, and in principle, one could achieve enlightenment in three weeks and three days. By the way, His Holiness has commented, Dalai Lama has commented, that if you've not developed bodhicitta, not developed realization of emptiness, etc., and you just go into a three-year retreat, if you're told when you're going into that, oh, well, you know, going to this three-year retreat, you might achieve Buddhahood in 3 years. He said, this is, and I quote, this is the same as communist propaganda. Don't believe it. It's baloney. And we have an enormous amount of empirical evidence. You know, it doesn't happen. You know. So if you're born an incredible prodigy already with bodhicitta and all of that, then who knows? Everything's possible. But ordinarily, forget about it. And so, Bhatu Rinpoche, according to this monk, he was at Segomba in eastern Tibet, this is what he had understood, Bhatu Rinpoche formulated, okay, here's a format, here's something set that you can do it, you know, if you put your mind to it, and you have some companions, you have a good Vajra Acharya, somebody who's capable, experienced, to guide you through it, then, you know, the chances are you really will be able to complete a three-year retreat. And then you've done something, right? And in that three-year retreat, you'll probably do the preliminaries, even if you've done the preliminaries, 100,000 Vajrasattva, 100,000 Guru Yoga, and so forth. Even if you've done that, you'll probably do them all over again. So the first year or so of the three-year retreat is going to be doing preliminary practices again. And then, over the course of that, depending on the tradition, then you'll do some stage of generation, maybe some protector practice, maybe more stage of generation, and then you might try a variety of stage of completion practice, maybe the six yogas of Naropa. Maybe you'll try the six-phase yoga of Kalachakra. You might, if you're following Kalachakra, then engage in the 108 asanas or physical exercises that are part of Kalachakra practice. So there are different modes. Or if you're doing Gelugpa, you might then spend most of your 3 years reciting hundreds of thousands of mantras or millions. So it becomes primarily a mantra recitation retreat. Okay? So there are different varieties there. But the long and the short of it is, I've never heard of a three-year retreat where you sit down and you practice shamatha until you achieve it. Or that you sit down and start meditating on emptiness until you gain realization. Or that you sit down and practice bodhicitta until you realize it. I think I just touched the basic ingredients. So one good friend of mine, who I respect very much, he's done the three-year retreat, and he found it of value, and he's a teacher, a very good teacher. He's encouraging other people to do it. And his description was, is in a three-year retreat, you get a sampling. You get a taste of the town. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of that. So you get a little bit of a taste, a little bit of experience of a wide variety of practices. So that's that if you're a very sincere practitioner, then you're now equipped. You've gained, just like in 8 weeks, you've gained familiarity, hopefully, with three modes of shamatha, the four immeasurables. So did you achieve any of them in 8 weeks? Well, no. If you dreamed that, then you were smoking a little bit too much before you came. Some familiarity, so that when you leave, you know how to practice. If there's sufficient inspiration, then you'll continue to do so. Likewise, in 3 years, you will, in a very similar fashion, have gained familiarity with not only preliminaries, but a number of state regeneration practices and state of completion practices. So you have a taste. You will have not achieved any of them, but you'll have some introduction to a number of them. And so he said, this friend of mine said, it's kind of like getting an undergraduate education in Vajrayana meditation. Okay? So that could be useful. That could be useful. So preparation for that, I would just say, as much shamatha, as much bodhicitta, four immeasurables, and realization of emptiness as you possibly can. Right? So that's the answer to the question. And then my own preference is, I just kind of look back, not very to ancient history, like, 1,500 years ago when so many Indian Buddhists were achieving the jhanas and had cities and so forth and so on. I just look back at the latter part of the 19th century, well before the civil wars in China was already unsettling things. There had to be a lot of nervousness around that, because it was really a lot of misery. And there were all these warlords all over China. We're talking about from the beginning of the 20th century up until 1949, when Mao Zedong won. But that first half of that century, I can only try to imagine how miserable and fearful that must have been to live in China during that time. Warlords all over the place, each one trying to be more rapacious than the other one, more exploitative. You never know when some bad one come in and just, wipe out your village or steal your lands. And civil war all over that went on for years and years and years. And so that was very unsettling. And of course, Tibet is right next door with a lot of merging of areas that were kind of Tibetan, kind of Chinese, like where the Dalai Lama himself was born, where my own teacher, Gyatso Rinpoche, my primary Dzogchen teacher, he's called Gyatul. Gya means Chinese. Tul is Tuku. He's Chinese Tuku. My teacher is Chinese, 100% Chinese. Right? But he was identified as a young child, as a tuku. And so these Tibetan lamas came to this Chinese couple and said, your kid, we want him. And I think they might have said, how much? And I don't know. But in fact, I think probably they were devout Buddhists. And they said, oh, our child's a tuku? Okay, go for it. I mean, that's the best we could hope for our child. This means he's going to get a terrific education. And by the way, we don't have to pay for it. No, I think in fact it was all very, very devotional. And so he was born Chinese. Very early on, brought into Tibetan monastery, received marvelous training. But the point there was that, okay, what is he? He's Chinese ethnically, he's totally Tibetan in terms of all of his education. He was born in an area where the Chinese and Tibetans were getting along very, very well, quite smoothly, and they did for centuries. At the same time, with all that civil war going on, it had to be a lot of unrest. So if we go back before then, back to the latter half of the 19th century, back before this whole thing of the three-year retreats had started, because that seemed to be latter part of the 19th century, right? Let's go back 5 years before then. And then what are the teachings? Before people got into this three-year retreat business, and then doing a second three-year retreat with a lot of repetition, I think sometimes it's more or less the same thing. Do it again and again and again. Let's run the movie back. What were they doing before then? And before then, if they were Galupa, they were practicing Lamrim, and they were developing bodhicitta, achieving shamatha, achieving vipassana, and then going on to stage of completion and generation. That's what they were doing. They weren't doing three-year retreats. They're actually following a path and gaining realization. And in Dzogchen, it was the same thing. They were developing, they're doing the preliminary practice and then immediately going to shamatha in text after text after text. And remarkably, my own lama, my primary lama, Nyingma Lama, Dzogchen Lama, when I was translating for him pretty much all through the 1990s, he just went from one text to the next. He was teaching a group of students, and I was his interpreter. But every single text that he taught while I was translating for him, it was always this. It was always, here are the preliminaries, now here's shamatha, here's vipassana, now here's mahamudra, here's the path. And text, natural liberation, spacious path to freedom, naked awareness, Vajra essence, one after, it always was coming back to the same. So I just feel a tremendous blessing that during the, I think it was about 7, 8 years that I was translating for him, that's what he just kept on coming back to. There it is. And it was so complementary to the training that I'd had for the first 20 years, which was largely Galupa, which again is all about the path. And here it is again. But now if we streamline that, okay, what is absolutely essential in the Dzogchen, then as I've said many times in the past, it is shamatha, it is vipassana, and then of course you augment that, you enrich that with the four immeasurables of bodhicitta practice, but where they're going, since they don't say this is absolutely indispensable, what the question is, for which this is the answer, what is absolutely indispensable to achieve rainbow body in this lifetime? And that includes great transference rainbow body. Do some people not know what great transference rainbow body is? This is the one I really want to see. Great transference rainbow body. There are different kinds of rainbow body. The standard one that happens about every 10 years and happened quite recently. Somebody just told me it happened in India. 2 Hindu swamis achieved rainbow body. So I had on good authority. But in Tibet, about every 10 years, rainbow body, when the person dies, rainbow lights all over the place, and then you look for the body and it just disappeared. All this remains is hair and nails. And that's happened many, many times, including in recent history. What happens much more rarely, and I'll just spend a couple of minutes, and then we'll get to out here. But great transference rainbow body. That's the real cherry on the cake, I have to say. And Dujum Lingba in the Vajra Essence, there he really unpacks it. He said there's different levels of rainbow body of just how much you display when you're checking out. And if it were a poker game, this is where you're showing your cards, right? This is like, now there's no, oh, shucks, I have no realization. It's like, da-da. <You know? laughs> And the great transference of rainbow body, I must say, the first time I heard about that, I said, oh, man, that's the one I want. that's the one, however long it takes. That's like, okay, my teacher, Ananda Maitreya, he wants to be Maitreya for Ananda, or Ananda for Maitreya. I want that one. Great transference rainbow body. Great transference rainbow body. You actually, while you're still alive and healthy, you completely dissolve all of the materiality of your body, all the atoms. You completely dissolve all the materiality of your body into its ultimate source, which is the energy of primordial consciousness, from which it springs. Just like your coarse mind comes from substrate, but the substrate consciousness comes from Rigpa. So likewise, this coarse, chunky body made out of all this yucky stuff that it's made out of, the atoms here, where are they fundamentally coming from? They're coming from the energy of primordial consciousness, which is indivisible from the absolute space of phenomena, indivisible from primordial consciousness. Those three, Dhammadhatu, primordial consciousness, and the energy of primordial consciousness. They are the ultimate trinity. They're absolutely indivisible, never can be separated. But all the materiality in the universe is emerging from that dimension. Just like space-time, relative space-time, emerges from Dhammadhatu, and all forms of consciousness emerge from Rigpa, or Yishe, which is primordial consciousness. And so as you're achieving an awakening, as you're awakening to the nature of reality, coarse mind dissolves into substrate, substrate dissolves into primordial consciousness, right? And from your perspective, relative space-time dissolves into Dhammadhatu, for which your primordial consciousness is absolutely indivisible, right? But that consciousness is not inert. It is imbued with infinite energy. It's called the energy of primordial consciousness. And it's out of that that all materiality of the world emerges. So you're taking this coarse, just like you have a coarse mind, you've got this coarse body, and through your practice, it can be done by way of Kala Chakra practice, done by way of Dzogchen practice, etc., but very, very explicitly in Dzogchen practice, through this practice of the tekchu and the trutgel, the breakthrough and the direct crossing over, you're just withdrawing or dissolving the materiality of your body step by step into the energy of primordial consciousness, so that if you complete that process while you're still alive, you still have a form. You have a form that other people could shake your hand. You could give them a hug and it would feel firm. Rather like hugging somebody in a dream. Or are you really there and I reach out, I'm wondering, am I dreaming? And I reach out and grasp Michael's hand or touch him on the knee or the elbow and say, ah, yeah, he's hard. He's really there. He's really there. Right? Lucid dream or not lucid dream, people are still firm. Touch somebody's elbow in a dream. Oh yeah, you're really there. You're really there. That's a hard elbow. Lucid dream, non-lucid dream, it's still a hard elbow. So it seems to be really there, but of course in a dream there's no materiality there at all, even though it feels as hard as a dream in the waking state, right? Well, so there you are. You've achieved great transference rainbow body. You've completely dissolved the materiality of your body into the energy of primordial consciousness, which means you don't die at all. There's nothing to die because this energy is unborn. It's as unborn as primordial consciousness, as unborn as Dharma Dhatu. There's nothing to die. There's nothing to decompose. It's unborn. And there you are, appearing perhaps in an ordinary form, but there's nothing to die. There's nothing left of your awareness except for pristine awareness, and that's unborn. So that doesn't die. And there's nothing left of your body except for this apparition, this holographic display of the energy of primordial consciousness. And since it wasn't born, it doesn't die. You don't have any organs, you don't have any bones, you don't have any blood, you don't have any materiality. It's just a form, a luminous, empty form. And you can transform that in any way you like, very much as if you were absolutely lucid in a dream. You can manifest as a turtle, as a cloud. The Dalai Lama was asked once, how do you like, what do you think you might be your next rebirth? And he said, I'm thinking about a meadow. Any way you like, you know. If you're there, if you like meadows, you're going to hang out with a meadow, let people come in. I'm full of flowers. You know, graze, you cows, you know. So what happened to people like Padmasambhava, who achieved great transference rainbow body, or Vimalamitra, great transference rainbow body? When they, in a certain place, they see their work is done, they just go, it's just withdraw the form. But there's no death, there's no rainbow, anything like that. It's already happened. So, now they're gone. Manifest someplace else, like in a lucid dream. Hola, so. So for that, what's indispensable? Shamatha, Vipassana, Tekchu, and Tutya. And you say, but what about bodhicitta? That's the very heart of the Mahayana. That's the very heart of the whole bodhisattva way of life. And as you might recall, bodhicitta, yeah. Realize rikpa, that's ultimate bodhicitta. Realize rikpa, relative bodhicitta comes out spontaneously. So you don't have to look outside of that to develop bodhicitta. Because it's not to develop, it's simply discovered. And it's because you've discovered its root, its ultimate nature, ultimate bodhicitta. Relative bodhicitta just comes out like a fountain. So you don't need to look elsewhere for it. Yeah. Any questions? That's what I just want to see. This great transference. I just want to see people going, whoop, whoop, whoop. Aha, now we've really arrived. Go ahead, Miles, carry on. After the microphone comes to you.
Okay.
Yes.
So once you achieve shamatha, how hard is it to maintain it, especially if you decide to return to a relatively active lifestyle where you're doing things and having relationships and creating within the within the conventional world.
Yeah, understood. One thing is that once you've achieved shamatha, you can just assume that from that point, your priorities will have shifted a lot. Things that were important now just arouse a chuckle. Okay, priorities may shift an awful lot. But I'll just give you the answer from His Holiness Dalai Lama. And that is, if you achieve shamatha in this lifetime, there's no good reason why you should lose it. No good reason why you should, unless you're just really foolish, irresponsible, ridiculous, like what's wrong with you, numbnuts, you know, you should be able to keep it for the rest of your life. Yeah. And, of course, it's common sense. And that's once you've achieved that, you will see for yourself how incredibly valuable it is. And then you'll simply not do anything in terms of lifestyle and so forth, and that would, by following it, would run the danger of losing it. You just wouldn't do it. You just wouldn't do it, saying, whatever it is, not worth it. Not worth losing this. And so there you are. So you'll at the very least maintain it. But if you've developed, you know, really meaningful motivation, then you won't simply sit there and enjoy it. Because there you got, you know, you got your own private shamatha jacuzzi you can slip into any time from that time on. But you won't just do that. If you've really got some wisdom behind it, then you say, ah, this is now. Okay, having a precious human rebirth, that's like a wish-fulfilling gem. Now I've got shamatha on top of that. This wish-fulfilling gem now is polished and ready to produce. So, you know, use it. Yeah. But yeah, you should be able to keep it for life. Yep. Oh, yeah. Anything else coming? Okay, Regina, sure.
So it is possible then that Padmasambhava was born in 8 years old in a lotus?
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Why not?
Why not? I mean, he was, you know, I don't mind, you know. People who are really skeptical, they already think I'm crazy. So I have nothing to defend. When a good friend of mine, a philosopher, says, Alan, he's very smart, but he's crazy. Judging where it came from, I'm very happy with that. If the Dalai Lama said that, then I think, okay, how can I stop being crazy? But from this person, oh, you think I'm crazy? Good, I'm happy with that. I'm the little pipsqueak, but a tiny pipsqueak of reflection of Milarepa. Milarepa said, the world thinks I'm crazy. Milarepa said, I think the world's crazy. Yeah. So your question was?
Pardon me?
Your question was?
My question is it possible if you disappear like Shatideva disappearing
why
into
not?
The sky? And
why not? Why not? Once you've realized emptiness. I mean, you know, the closest analogy is lucid dream. Lucid dream. If you're in a lucid dream, let's imagine you fall asleep lucidly. Now, that would be a close analogy to Padmasambhava. He fell asleep lucidly, which means he came into the dream lucidly. That is, he was born in where he was, Odian, lucidly. Okay? So imagine, now just as a parallel, just an analogy, just for fun. But let's imagine tonight you fall asleep lucidly. And then something arouses your substrate consciousness that you're ready to have a dream. But you enter right into the dream from the very beginning lucidly. You're lucid in the substrate consciousness, luminous, vacuum, wide awake, clear, but you're asleep. And then you break the symmetry of that and you crystallize and you actually have some notion, I think maybe there, I'd like to have a dream there, and that's who I'd like to be, right? Maybe northern India, beautiful mountains there. You know, Pakistan-Afghanistan border. A bit troublesome nowadays, but Padmasambhava's time, really beautiful, right? So maybe there, and maybe I'll come in almost literally with a splash. Could you, if you were dreaming, could you, since it's your dream, could you then not simply manifest in the dream already 8 years old in a lotus? Why not? It's fun. Why not? What's to prevent? Everybody who's in the dream who's non-lucid, they think, oh, miracle. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. And from your perspective, miracle, give me a break. I'm awake. That's all you need, to be awake. And you can be born any way you like. And then when you're ready to, in your dream, when you see that in this particular dreamscape, you've done all the good that you can for the time being, then you and just go right back into the substrate again. So the parallel is really cool. And we say, well, but why couldn't you? Why couldn't you? Because when you tapped into that depth of consciousness, then the laws of physics just don't hold. And this theme, it actually runs through physics. And that is classical physics, right up to and not including Max Planck, the year 1900. You've got Newtonian mechanics, you have the electromagnetism of James Clerk Maxwell, classical physics. Well, and that's based on the assumption that space and time, matter, energy are absolute, right? Well, there's an awful lot of truth. I mean, it's fantastic physics. I've studied it. I did the mathematics, all of it. And it's fantastic physics. It's brilliant physics. But within that context, some things are simply impossible. Like the truths that come out of relativity theory and the truths that come out of quantum mechanics. That's impossible. Quantum entanglement, no way. That's absolutely impossible. And so what we see here is that the laws of classical physics are true within a limited context. But if you go down to the atomic and subatomic level, those laws are no longer true. And if you start traveling at speeds of light, velocities that approach the speed of light, relativistic velocities, then the ordinary law, they're not true anymore. In other words, they were never absolutely true. They were only true within that framework, right? But they're not absolutely true. And they thought they were, and this is why a lot of physicists just had to die. They just couldn't get their minds around quantum mechanics and relativity theory. So people like Poincaré and so forth, they never accepted. They just died, and then that's how physics progresses, by burial from burial, you know. Well, in a similar fashion, and that's a statement from physics, that, you know, science progresses burial by burial, funeral by funeral. So the natural universe, as it's now understood in this year right now in modern science, is a universe based upon the assumption that consciousness plays no significant role in the universe at all. It's accidental. It's a byproduct, very localized within this brain and that brain. Its significance cosmologically is zero. And moreover, the mind equals coarse mind, psyche. That's all there is to it. That's what psychologists study. The subconscious, the conscious, but nevertheless, it's just psyche. It's that which arises independent upon the brain. And that's it. That's the whole show. And all that other stuff, parapsychology and clairvoyance and so forth, that's just hogwash. We still don't take that seriously because that doesn't fit into our paradigm. So out with it. And that's why virtually no real money, no serious money goes to any research like that. It's not allowed, frankly. Yeah. And then, of course, it's easy to laugh at because no money was given to do rigorous research. And they say, your research wasn't rigorous. You know. It's kind of a cheap shot, and so when we read about the statements from Tibetan Buddhism and Hinduism and Sufism and Taoism and the shamanic traditions all over the world, and they're making claims that just kind of blow to smithereens modern physics and the rules of what can and cannot happen, well, they are all operating, they're dealing with a universe in which consciousness has a very crucial, fundamental role in the universe, and there's a lot more to mind than the psyche. They all know that. It's only scientific materialists who don't. They're the odd man out. All the rest of them do, right? But Eurocentric civilization has been so dominant and so suffocating and so oppressive to all the other traditions. The most classic was the Cultural Revolution in China, where they annihilated the depth of their own wisdom, with some stupid ideas of some German dead guy. A German dead guy. You would think that they would be at least have enough ethnic pride that they would be, you know, dominated by some dead Chinese guy. But it's Marx, for crying out loud. I mean, what? I thought you people had ethnic pride, you know, and you dumped on your own tradition by the stupid ideas of some dead German guy? Man, that's weird. They had so much natural pride, and understandably, it's a great civilization. And they creamed it with the idiotic notions of Marx. That's really sad. Snuffed out Taoism, Confucianism, multiple schools of Buddhism. Oy, oy, oy. And they got a bowl of rice in return. What a crappy deal, you know? So the long and the short of it is that the laws of physics, chemistry, biology right now, these are the laws of nature in a world in which consciousness doesn't exist at all. Or if it does, it's trivial and has no significance. Okay? And so it's, cognitively speaking, it's non-relativistic laws of nature. Because consciousness just doesn't matter. Right? Well, all the great contemplative traditions of the world know that's not true. And Buddhism just knows it in spades. And so from the Buddhist perspective, as the Dalai Lama said, and I know it's kind of tough for some people to hear, but I heard him say it with my own ears, when it comes to physics and the understanding of the laws of nature of the outer world, I, Dalai Lama, listen to science with great respect. When it comes to the mind, you people are in kindergarten. You know? And so I just find it enormously gracious of him to enter into conversation after conversation after conversation with neuroscientists, psychologists. And if he ever raises the issue of reincarnation, they shut him up quickly. And he said, oh, I'd be throwing food myself. You know, but that's I'm immature. You know, I just want to take some spaghetti and but he just smiles. He says, oh, you're my teacher. You're my teacher. Incredible humility. So that's it. The laws of science stand. They are marvelous. Just like Newton's laws are marvelous. They're fantastic. They're elegant. They're brilliant. Years ago when I was studying in Amherst, this old Jewish professor, marvelous. It was a piece of art. It was the end of our advanced calculus course. And it's just one of the most memorable. Did I tell the story already? I don't think so. It was advanced calculus. And this was little Amherst College, a jewel of a college. I praise it, and I'm so grateful. They gave me a free education. And they had, in that semester, they had more students signing up for advanced calculus than normal, and they always kept the classes small. So they asked this old Jewish professor, he had escaped from Germany before the Holocaust, if he'd fill in. He'd retired like 20 years earlier, 15 years earlier. He's like 80 years old, but his mind clear as a bell. So he taught the class. He was my professor. And he was just so splendid. He was like a mathematics llama, you know? And when we came to the end of the course, he said, now, and he still spoke with this kind of German accent. He said, now I want to show you something. And he spent the whole, however long it was, the whole class period, with like three blackboards. And he said, I want to show you how Newton derived his laws. And then he went, starting on the left board, and he would write, and he'd turn to you, do you see? And then he'd write more. Do you see? Do you see? And he filled all the, do you see? And it was like he was Mozart writing a symphony, or it was a work of art. It was a celebration. It was brilliant. And he had such love for it. It was, I mean, even my talking, I think you can get some sense of it. It was so contagious that he sensed the aesthetic of mathematics and the brilliance of Newton. So when I say that Newton's laws are limited, I say so with enormous respect. When I say that the laws of modern neuroscience are limited, they don't know the nature of correlations, it's brilliant science. I know some really such outstanding scientists in the field. And it's true within that bracket. Let us assume that consciousness plays no significant role, that it's just emerging out of neurons. Let's assume that. In which case, all the laws hold. But as soon as you break out of that, and you recognize, wait a minute, you're dealing with the pond scum of consciousness. I mean, just the thinnest film of consciousness, filled with rumination, with bugs, you know. But penetrate through that, and suddenly there's this whole substrate consciousness, which is a portal to form realm and formless realm and paranormal abilities and extrasensory perceptions. And that's just, we're just get warming up here. And this is before we penetrate all the way through to Rigpa. And so as soon as you do, you know that, then you are now in relativistic, cognitively relativistic laws of nature, where there's tremendously more malleability. Tremendously more. Just as there's tremendously more malleability in a quantum world than in a Newtonian one. You know, quantum teleportation is pretty cool. It's true. But it would have looked absurd in the 19th century to even talk about it. They said, oh, this is ridiculous. Or the space-time, the twins problem in relativity theory, and all, you know, all the implications of Einstein's theories just from special relativity. 19th century, they say, but this is ridiculous. This is magical thinking. Who are you, Jules Verne? You know, this is crazy. You know, because they understood only within non-relativistic, and that's what all of science is today. It's non-relativistic. It's non-relativistic because we have no science of consciousness, and we just don't have one. If you can't measure it, you can't define it, you don't know what causes it, you don't know what it does, and you don't know how it interfaces with the brain, I think you have to say we don't have a science. The Buddhists do, Hindus do, Taoists do, Sufis do, but it hasn't quite got together yet. So, to really stretch the imagination, you know, Chantakirti, debating with this Brahmin, non-Buddhist, Chantakirti, debating. And the fellow was just always holding, as debaters often do, just holding to his own views, not really persuaded, logic, schmagic, you know. And then finally, Chantigiri, I think I got a bit tired of the debating. And he said, okay, I want to demonstrate to you, I'm not going to argue with you anymore. I'm just going to demonstrate the non-inherent nature of all phenomena. For example, how about this? And he drew a cow on the wall of his little cottage where they're having the debate. He drew an outline of a cow. No, nothing special about that. But it was quite special when he milked it. Then just ask, could you do that in a lucid dream? Why not? If you're lucid, if you're in a non-lucid dream, forget about it. That would be impossible. But if you're lucid, tell me exactly what's now impossible if you're lucid. There we are. So, 'twas the night before Christmas. All through the house. Children were dreaming of Great Transference Rainbow Body. I'd really love to see that much more frequently. I must say that. Really love to see that. You know, they've been saying for a long time in the Tibetan tradition, when things get really bad, the era is really degenerate. That's the time when Dzogchen will really spread its wings and really show its strength, its might. But okay. Do we have to really get more degenerate than now? I think this is enough. I think this is enough, okay? Can we have now Dzogchen going to really spread its wings? And that's just my personal opinion, then we will take a break. I'm just not seeing it happen from the three retreats. I'm just not seeing it happen. People don't achieve shamatha, they don't develop bodhicitta, they don't realization of emptiness. They get a taste of all these practices, and then often they finish, or they do it twice or three times, which is cool. But what happened to the good old-fashioned way that was right through the 19th century, from the time of Padmasambhava and earlier, right through the 19th century, where people were actually achieving shamatha, achieving pashana, blah, 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 and then 13 disciples of Dujum Limba achieving rainbow body. 13 from one teacher. So I look at that, and then I look at the marvelous teachers nowadays and say, how many of your students have seen rainbow body? How long have you been teaching? Your Honor, I rest my case. Enjoy your dinner.